You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 2nd of February, 2022. The first thing I want to get out of the way is the all-important issue of my donation method. As some of you know, I lost my PayPal two weeks ago, and have been busy setting up alternative methods. I've already set up a main electronic donations system. It's on my personal website. Go about halfway down. It's that blue box with the Byzantine eagle in it. It says, support the Orthodox Medievalist here. And the exact same thing is on Radio Albion. So that's been solved. And people have been donating to it. It's no problem. Or with it. I also have a Coinbase account and a wallet that's also found on the Radio Albion page, both the main page and my personal page on that network. And pretty soon, I'm going to set up a P.O. box. And on top of all that, I still have the Cash App. My Cash App name is, it's a $Raphael71, and I received some money there too. And so it's real easy, all these things, no problem, and I would prefer it if you would use it regularly. So, with that out of the way, I want to get to my topic for today, something that I've been researching for some time, partially because it has a personal connection to me, and it's something that very few people really know about. It's surprisingly unknown, and that is the Irish Civil War of 1922-1923, basically over the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1922. It's rare that I recommend movies, but it came out in the mid-90s. Michael Collins with Liam Neeson and a bunch of other big names, the guy that played Snape on Harry Potter, Alan Rickman, whatever the heck his name is. He plays Eamon de Valera. Liam, of course, plays Michael Collins. It's not a great date movie. I know this from experience. It's very long and very serious. And, but, you know, it's definitely, it's worthwhile. It's very sympathetic to the Irish cause. Now, it's, personal, only in the sense that my grandparents left Ireland, briefly went to England where they met and then, emigrated to America more or less as refugees because of the Civil War. So technically, my grandparents were more or less refugees. And this war, you know, you're not talking about very high casualties. You are talking about a lot of displacement. You're talking about a lot of destruction. But because so many of the soldiers on both sides were not well trained and not well disciplined, you have a lot of blind shooting. The weaponry was very poor. But it was all over the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1922. This was, and again, this is featured at the end of the Michael Collins movie, which is very well done, very accurate in a lot of ways. This is the conditional independence of Ireland from the British Empire. you're aware that from the 13th century onward, more or less, the British Empire occupied Ireland as its main and first colony, under the most exploitative system imaginable. White slavery largely derives from the Cromwellian era, and a bit before and a bit after, where POWs, these guerrillas, these revolutionaries, were sent either to Australia or the Caribbean to die a pretty miserable death as chattel slaves. Ireland was depopulated in the early modern period because not only of the warfare, but of the slave trade. You had several million Irish sent into slavery from the 16th to the 17th century. These weren't, unlike the African slaves that were born slaves and then bartered for something like weaponry, the Europeans, these were free men who were enslaved. And because, I mean, can you imagine being an Irishman with that kind of skin being sent to the sugarcane field in Barbados? This is the origin of the term redneck, from what I understand. So, finally, 1921, the British had had enough. After World War I, they were exhausted. And the Irish revolutionaries finally forced Great Britain out of the country, but to save face, the British government had a few conditions. And these conditions were placed into the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and because some of them are pretty outrageous from the Irish point of view, you had a substantial, never a majority, but a substantial proportion of the population that opposed it. The treaty says a few things. Article 1 makes it a part of the Commonwealth, which means, in Article number 3, it will have a Governor General. Technically, the Governor General can veto laws. It can call or dissolve the Parliament or the Doyle. Laws technically needed royal assent, so they really could veto if absolutely necessary. And at least in certain cases, judges can be appointed or should be appointed by the Governor General. It doesn't come up so much, but that was one of the more outrageous aspects of this. And of course, Article 4, which was a central aspect that ignited the war, was the oath to the King of England. And that oath, which was abolished a few years later, is one of the things that really set people, you had to give your oath to King George at the time. Article number 5, public debt proportional to the size of the country still had to be paid by the Irish state. And number 6, Article 6, Ireland could not have a navy. Coastal protection was done by the Imperial British Navy. Number 8, and this sounds like Versailles a little bit, that the Irish military could not be larger than the British proportional to population. Article 9, ports had to be fully open for British trading vessels. Number 10, this is also outrageous, the Irish state had to pay for all of those officials, including policemen, that now were out of a job because Ireland was technically independent. They had to compensate them, pay for relocation and everything else, judges, officials, clerks, policemen, whatever. Of course, Section 11 was also something that ignited the war, and that was the separation of Ulster from the rest of Ireland for two reasons, partially because it was a place where you could gerrymander it in such a way you can get a Protestant majority, even though the population was almost equal. And number 2, this is where the bulk of the industry was. And that would have been the economic engine for a united Ireland. Actually, even in Article 13, you see that the so-called Free State, which is what I'm going to use to describe the 32 counties, that part of Ireland that's not Ulster, as Southern Ireland. And they used it with a capital S to suggest that this is actually the state. And Article 16, finally, that Ireland could not be officially a Catholic country, even the Free State. It had to, Protestants had to be on equal footing with Catholics throughout the 32 counties. So that's what ignited the Civil War. The way that Michael Collins put it, and his supporters, Cosgrave and the rest of them, was that this isn't full independence, especially when you consider the idea that Ireland was absolutely dependent on Britain economically. I think the slogan was, this is a means to achieve freedom, not freedom itself. And so many of these almost negated independence to the point where it really wasn't an independent country. It was only a name. You know, the Governor General alone. I mean, indeed, but the oath, because of its symbolism, was one of the worst things in this that caused. I mean, when De Valera was elected, even before then, I think the oath was abolished. I think De Valera did it. But this was, and of course, payment of debt. You know, and if you're ordered to pay debt and pay these officials who now had to go back to England, it meant that your fiscal policy was under British control. Still, with all that, a majority of Irishmen supported the treaty. My grandmother, being from County Longford, was not one of them. So, it really, look at the map of Ireland, it was really the Southwest that was the heart of the anti-treaty forces. Now, the Irish Republican Army split into two factions. The majority rejected the treaty. So when I refer to the anti-treaty side, I'm just going to say the IRA, or possibly the irregulars, which is, I think, is more the term that was actually used at the time. So they had combined about 13,000 men by 1922. But some of the anti-treaty forces did not helped their cause very much. We refer to the other side, the treaty side, as the Free State, which was the term used at the time. 1922, there were 600 bank robberies carried out by the anti-treaty forces, and that did not help their cause. There's a lot of things that both sides did to hurt their cause, but the anti-treaty side did things like this all the time. Arson and contract killings also hurt their cause, and then of course the reprisals made it worse. The Free State reprisals were just as bad as what the anti-treaty side did. And on both sides, you really didn't have a full military command structure yet, especially the Irish Republican Army. So you had very poor military discipline, and the elite of the Free State military were the Dublin Guards, that later on were said to have committed some of the atrocities. We'll get to that here in a minute. Otherwise, the Free State Army was inexperienced, very young, very few experienced officers. And so this is one of the reasons that things got out of control in a very short period of time, and also the reason that law and order had broken down in 1922, 1923. So despite casualties being relatively low, I mean, say, compared to the American Civil War, these factors really destroyed the economy for a time. The other part of the treaty that people forget is that the British threatened to reoccupy the country if this thing wasn't signed. And that's one of the reasons that Michael Collins and his majority, one of the reasons they were very quick to sign this. I'm not sure the British were willing to do this, but that was a threat. And maybe one of the reasons that a majority supported it. Of the 32 free counties, 24 supported the treaty. As this is going on, you had a very quick, when Ulster was first declared a separate entity, you know, they became part of Britain almost immediately. And one of the first things they did, the Belfast regime engaged in a pogrom of Roman Catholics, driving them out of areas, making sure that they had no public positions, and throwing them out of the economy, kind of like the regime does to me. Now, the anti-treaty forces, of course, were not idiots. They were aware that they were in the minority. When the Free State demanded a referendum take place. De Valera, who, of course, was the main supporter of the anti-treaty forces, though he did more or less reconcile later, did everything in their power to keep that from happening. So the damage done both psychologically and physically to the country, the dislocation of many, including my grandparents, who were very different ideologically. You know, my grandmother, who was from Longford, died at almost 100. She didn't have much to say about it, but she definitely came from the anti-treaty side. My grandfather, who was from far to the north, not only was, God, he was not even a drinker. He died at something early 50s. I never met him, of course. He died when my father was in Korea. Tended to be more or less of a unionist, yet they married. But the casualties, I mean, the latest estimates for the Free State, you had just under 1,000 that were killed. 426 for the anti-treaty IRA. The only large number is that of the POWs, which were almost 15,000 taken by the Free State once the war, over the time, especially after the war was over. Now, the treaty itself did pass the legislature in 1922 to a vote of 64 to 57. So despite the roughly 75% support for the treaty, that's not how it worked out given the districting of the Irish state. And then, short time later, De Valera was re-upped as president, and it was 60 to 58. So the country was deeply divided, especially its elite. And not only did Britain threaten to invade or just not leave if the treaty wasn't signed, Michael Collins, you know, the military leader anyway of the pro-treaty forces, among others, was willing to not enforce certain aspects of the treaty even if it was signed. He begged the British for some kind of compromise on these things to avoid a war, but the British said no. So I have the feeling that when he came back from these negotiations, he was well aware that there was going to be some kind of violence. He tried to, smooth over some of the most severe aspects of this, but the British said either this is going to, anyway, this is Lloyd George, Winston Churchill, this was a group of people who were negotiating from the British side, said independence is out of the question unless this is signed precisely as it is. One of Collins' jobs was to integrate. I mean, no longer was the IRA necessary except in the North. So if you're going to have now an independent country, you have to have a regular army. And the Irish Republican Army was to be integrated into the regular forces. Because that didn't happen, you had a relatively small Free State Army made up of much younger men. And again, if you see the movie Michael Collins, they make fun of this on a pretty regular basis. And that's why it's an extremely accurate movie, historically speaking. The anti-treaty military leader, or one of the overarching leaders, was Rory O'Connor. And he was the individual who actually started the war. He started the shooting, showing their contempt for the British, almost inviting an invasion. The IRA killed Field Marshal Henry Wilson in the British Army June 22nd of 1922. Militarily, as far as the Irish Civil War was concerned, the IRA took the group of buildings called the Four Courts over the River Liffey. And that's what began it. Michael Collins was forced to attack it and to retake it, and the IRA surrendered. This was the first major action. So by that time, anti-treaty IRA, again, roughly 12,000, and the pro-treaty IRA, and this is as the shooting began, was roughly 8,000, and the so-called National Army, which was relatively small. But the anti-treaty IRA had even less discipline than the government had. They're used to really only guerrilla actions, not regular pitched battles, which they were not trained for, didn't understand. And as I mentioned, the Free State had very few officers. The anti-treaty IRA were easily defeated. Most of the towns in the South were taken by the end of 1922. And the basic areas, their strength was Limerick, Mayo, Cork, Kerry. The only real pitched battle of the war was Kilmallock. And these southern states were put together in something called the Munster Republic, a de facto state with De Valera as its president. By August of 1922, this stronghold was also taken with relative ease by the Free State. So, under normal circumstances, the Irish Republican Army would have simply surrendered and accepted the treaty as a matter of simply as an inevitability. But they didn't. The IRA then stopped the idea, since all their towns had been taken. Their equipment was very poor. Discipline was non-existent. They went to what they knew best, and that was guerrilla war. Strangely, this is one of the things that turned the tide for some time. They stopped trying to hold on to towns or regions. The Munster Republic, which wasn't meant to be a state, just kind of more of a conception than anything else, from August of 1922 to May of 1923, they stopped urban warfare and went out into the countryside and used typical guerrilla tactics that they were actually very good at. This is where Michael Collins was killed in an ambush in August of 1922. But the Free State was bleeding badly. This is where the bulk of their casualties came from, even to the point where some people were thinking that the Free State was going to fall to pieces. That eventually stopped, and the Free State was able to gain the initiative in that respect. So, again, a normal person would have simply surrendered at this point, but the anti-treaty forces then turned to terrorism. There is a definite line between guerrilla warfare, which is legitimate under certain circumstances, and now terrorism against things like public works, civilian centers, assassinations. And as a result of this, especially after Michael Collins's murder, the Free State then began shooting POWs. I don't want to exaggerate their numbers. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But they were not treated very well. Starting roughly in November of 1922, the guerrilla and then the terror campaign forced some very harsh reprisals from the Free State. There were a few things that really harmed the guerrilla cause of the anti-treaty forces. Beyond all the other things that I've mentioned, the Church of Rome condemned the guerrilla tactics of the anti-treaty IRA and fully supported the Free State. Any anti-treaty forces in the Irish Republican Army were refused the sacrament, which is a big deal in the early 20s in Ireland. Beyond that, the United States recognized the Free State, which was a huge problem, given the huge number of Irishmen that lived there. And then finally, the media throughout Ireland was strongly in support of the Free State. But still, that was partially because the Dublin government, the Free State government, instituted a pretty harsh reign of censorship. But that's no different than what Abraham Lincoln did. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was throwing newspaper editors in prison. World War II, you had massive censorship of the press. Only time that didn't happen was in Vietnam. And, of course, it happens today on a far harsher level than at the time. But still, even without it, most of the major editors backed the Free State. February of 1923, Liam Deasy, was one of the military leaders of the anti-treaty forces, called on the IRA to stop the war. The military council of the anti-treaty IRA refused. And there was another call on the 23rd of March, 1923. They also refused. By April 10th, most of the major anti-treaty forces had been captured, and all of their strongholds in the South were overrun. Officially, the Civil War ended July 31st, 1923. But now, we'll talk in a minute where it actually did continue. It was reignited in 1925 at a very low level. But during the Terror Campaign, which to some extent didn't really end in the 31st of July, 1923, but you had, and this is one of the problems that we've had with the Irish Republican Army, as sympathetic as I am to the Irish cause, many of you know that the IRA developed a strongly, from the anti-treaty side, a strongly leftist tinge. How absurd, even today, you can have a group that fought for sovereignty and independence give that away to multinational organizations. They fight for independence and sovereignty for the Celtic people, and yet have no problem with bringing in and assisting the invasion of the country from third world forces, hostile third world forces. It's an absurdity, but this is what happens when you try to satisfy the regime, which of course they can never do. And of course the old Catholic connection, the IRA, is long gone, partially because of the excommunication of the anti-treaty IRA. Was one of the things that knocked them out of contention. The Communist Party supported the anti-treaty forces. And the class idea, one of the things that made the... We know that the guerrilla faction had ended, the guerrilla period ended, and the terror began, was that the wealthy, especially the Protestant, Anglo-Irish landowners, had their homes burned to the ground. Almost 200 of the mansions of the wealthy Free State supporters were burnt. I mean, 77 just in January and February of 23 alone. So when the guerrilla war started, and especially when the terrorism began, and again, the guerrilla force deals with military operations, just a different style of military operations. It's when you're in the tiny minority. Guerrilla warfare makes a lot more sense. You can't even engage in pitched battles. But terrorism begins when you start attacking civilian infrastructure and civilian institutions. When that began, Dublin passed the emergency powers. And again, this is something that sometimes went too far, but again, with the lack of discipline, it makes a lot of sense that you're going to get some, and there's nothing worse that you had these people who were fighting on the same side for decades, now are at each other's throats. Fighting is always the worst when you have people roughly on the same side fighting over points of discipline, points of doctrine. You see this in religion, you see this in politics. We know that those opposing us are our enemies, but when we feel betrayed by our own people, it gets far worse and it gets far more violent. There were also elections. The treaty forces did have an electoral mandate. We'll talk more about that in a minute. 1927, the Governor General was abolished. And 1931, this is prior to De Valera taking over. Law was passed where the Governor General, actually Governor General didn't exist. They were not in the Commonwealth anymore. Therefore, several years later, they said that the British could not interfere in Irish politics. But if it were an independent country, that wouldn't even be an issue. That's the whole definition of independence. But when you have these financial aspects of the treaty that I mentioned, and they want to ensure payment, especially the debt, and all of this was eventually abolished. That means that someone, whether it be tax gathering, fiscal policy, ways and means, all of this was being watched over by the Governor General and his own cabinet. The only thing that those two sides had in common at the time, and when the war was going on, was that they were both supporting the Irish Republican Army in Ulster, especially after the pogroms, right after the treaty was signed. So after Collins was killed, this was a watershed for them. They considered it a murder, not a military act. In other words, despite Collins being a soldier, being shot was not an act of war or an act during war. It was a murder, which also meant that the anti-treaty IRA were now considered a criminal gang rather than a guerrilla organization. These were criminal acts now, not just things done over the course of a war. The emergency powers, which were reignited in 1925, gave the security forces far more leeway than before. And this is one of the reasons that some of the POWs, as they began to pile up, were treated so poorly. On the other hand, the Free State also said that any anti-treaty soldier, Irish Republican Army, if he laid down their arms and accepted the treaty in the Free State in general, would be amnesty. When all of this took place, when the reprisals of the Free State were known, one of the military leaders, William Lynch, of the anti-treaty forces, then made a decree saying that anyone, civilian or otherwise, who backs the emergency powers passed by Dublin would be shot on sight. And the same would go for newspaper editors, economic elites, anyone like that. This is one of the decisions that the IRA took that removed them from guerrilla action and brought them to sheer terror. Member of Parliament, Sean McGarry, one of the victims of the house burning campaign, had his house burned down on December 10th of 22. The problem was the IRA that did this didn't realize that his 7-year-old was in the house, and he was burned to death. This was extremely bad press for the provisional or the anti-treaty Irish Republican Army. And it's one of the things that, you know, the IRA was a revered institution, at least outside of Ulster, up until this point. And because they now killed inadvertently a 7-year-old, again, this is one of the many things that caused reprisals, not just militarily, but also internationally, diplomatically, and the absolute rejection of much of the IRA by the population. So whatever mystique they may have had was removed by December of 1922. One of the reasons that this war dragged on, you know, the provisionals, I'm sorry, the anti-treaty IRA was so outgunned and outcommanded, despite the problems on both sides, this war would have been over very quickly. And in fact, it was over very quickly had they not gone off into the countryside. And the result of this, people like Liam Lynch and the rest of the military council of the anti-treaty forces refused all negotiations. That means the war would drag on. It would also mean the Free State thought itself justified in slowly but surely amping up the security services and what they were allowed to do. Now, the anti-treaty forces tried to claim that they were slaughtering POWs, and it simply wasn't the case. Those who were shot was less than 1% of that 12,000. One of the things, however, that was very unpleasant from the Free State is that not all of those who were executed were shot. Some of them were used to clear minefields, which is just another way of killing them. So they kind of wander around until they got blown up by something, more or less. And that authorization came on March 23rd of 23. That somehow reignited an interest and support for the Irish Republican Army. And in the southern provinces, you did have some civilian violence against the Free State. Now, I mentioned the two elections, 1922 and 1923. These elections were called throughout Ireland to gauge public support for the treaty. Now, despite media censorship, the anti-treaty forces did gain 36 seats, pro-treaty 58. The Labour Party was run by Thomas Johnson. Generally speaking, supporting the treaty, had 17 additional seats for that cause. And you had about a 62.5% turnout. The Labour Party in Ireland, you had a big split over the treaty, but Johnson was, threw his weight to Collins. A year later, you had another election. De Valera, the political head of the anti-treaty forces, his faction gained 44 seats. The pro-treaty side, Cosgrave side, got 63, with a 61% turnout. Labour lost a few seats, and that was reduced to 14. So given all that, as I said before, the population, if polled as a whole, was roughly 75% in support. That would include all parties, not just the specifically pro-treaty one. The IRA in Ulster overwhelmingly rejected the treaty. There was the overwhelming majority supported the treaty. Although that's been disputed, the Belfast commander, Joe McKelvey, supported the treaty outright. Otherwise, we kind of don't know. It said that the overwhelming majority rejected the treaty, but since there was no polling up there, and everything was done in secret as a guerrilla organization, it's very hard to tell. The literature generally says that few IRA in the North supported the treaty, but that's been rejected by people of some competence. Now, 1925. And I mentioned that the war would be reignited a few years later. The anti-treaty IRA went to the Soviet Union for support. They wanted... Oh, and by the way, I should mention, and this is extremely important, one of the big reasons that the pro-treaty forces won, even during the guerrilla campaign, is that the British government was supplying them money and weapons. The only tanks, artillery that were used were from the Free State. The other issue, and this is what makes the anti-treaty violence such a problem, is that the British made it clear that if this isn't solved, and this war isn't brought to a close, the British will do it themselves, which would mean yet another reoccupation of the country. Ireland was in a position of weakness no matter what happened. Anyway, 1925, the anti-treaty forces went to the USSR. They received £500 a month in exchange for spying. Generally, they were meant to spy on the treaty ports because part of the treaty mentions explicitly that the Royal Navy has full run of the Irish coastline. This was the only reason that, this is 1925, Lenin had died, Stalin vaguely took over, it wasn't consolidated yet, but this was Stalin's decision. And so the only thing they really did for the Soviet Union was send some technical manuals, things like that, from the Royal Navy through the so-called treaty ports. They also, roughly around this time, created the Friends of Soviet Russia Committee. The very fact they call it Soviet Russia shows you how clueless they are as to what they were dealing with. Of course, you know, any kind of Russian nationalism was banned, even in the Russian Republic. Russia was sunk into the Soviet Union that had no legal standing. So the Friends of Soviet Russia was one of the creations of the anti-treaty IRA. You did have some grumbling about it, and this is the origin of certain aspects of the more extreme parts of the IRA, so-called provisionals and the rest of it, moving to the left in their political sympathies. This is where it came from. There's no such thing as a left-wing nationalism. This doesn't make any sense. Leftism is cosmopolitan by definition. So between the ending of the war in 23 and the low-level reignition of the war in 1925, many, even in the pro-treaty side, saw the Free State as a hard pill to swallow. You had a collapse of the economy. We'll get to that in a second. You had mass censorship. You had a lot of incompetence, because you have people who spent their lives as guerrillas now having to run a country, which are two very different things. And, of course, the sensationalized abuse of anti-IRA prisoners, especially the mine-clearing campaign. So 25 came and went. 26, the war was restarted. Two Free State guards were killed in an attack on the barracks in the south. And then the Special Powers Act, or the Security Services Act, was reinstituted. The IRA killed Minister Kevin O'Higgins in 1927. This didn't last very long. De Valera, head of the anti-treaty forces, ran in for election in 1932, and his party won. And as a result of this, though, winning an election, it's one thing if you just refuse to take a seat, like they used to do in the British Parliament. But once he was elected, once he took over, he had to make his peace with the treaty. A lot of the worst elements of it were pretty much already gone, but he went along with it and refused to attack the Free State, which now he's running. And Cosgrave was very gracious about this. No one was quite sure what the pro-treaty elements were going to do now that they had to hand over power to those who wanted to kill them a few years ago. But they did. And it was a pretty brilliant move. Cosgrave said they're not even going to say anything. He handed over all the elements of power, the legislature, the prime minister, to De Valera's forces. By 1937, a new constitution was written for the Republic of Ireland. It completely eliminated the oath to the British monarch. It eliminated any references to the crown in any respect. And, significantly, it did lay claim to Ulster. In fact, even prior to that, De Valera banned the Irish Republican Army. He also banned the Blue Shirts, which is a strongly nationalist group, along with the Architects of the Resurrection, one of my favorite names for a political party, that was founded in 1942. These were both banned by the De Valera government. It's very odd that Eamon de Valera, by the way, his name doesn't sound very Irish, de Valera was half Cuban. He wins in 1932. By 35, he bans the Irish Republican Army en masse. Okay. De Valera is coming to power. 1932. Started what we call another era of war between Ireland and England, and it came to be known as the Anglo-Irish Trade War from 1932 to 1938. One of the more obnoxious aspects of the conditions whereby Britain would vacate Ireland was that peasants or tenant farmers who bought their land from former Anglo-Irish elites had to pay their annuities to Britain, to their former owners. The concept was that tenant farmers shouldn't be tenants anymore. They should be subsidized in buying their land, very low rates, but the previous owners had to be compensated. It's the same thing in Russia in 1861. This is something that was canceled. The problem was that this was a pretty huge amount of money. Every year, the British no longer had. De Valera was almost courting disaster here. Making matters worse. And I understand the mentality here. In fact, I may have supported it if I were alive at the time. One of the first things this man did in getting elected was throw tariffs on British goods. The problem here is that, even in 1932, Irish independence was largely a fiction. You can't be independent when 80-85% of your economy is completely dependent on British markets, British products, British investment, British banks. Making matters worse, it's 1932. which means that the Depression was all over the place. The Depression is going to be solved in Germany very shortly, but not in the Western world. The Depression destroyed then whatever other markets were available for Irish, usually at this time, you know, Ireland would almost be considered third world through no fault of its own, but for its raw materials and anything else it made, these markets were closed. The point, however, was something that the government made very clear. I mean, they admitted there's going to be hardships here, but something that the nation has to do as a whole and is highly sympathetic, and that was to cut all dependence on England and Great Britain, so-called United Kingdom, which would include Northern Ireland, of course. Of course, the treaty, one of the very obnoxious aspects of the treaty, as I mentioned, is that it assumed part of the debt of the British Empire as one of the conditions for so-called independence. Even in 1925, that was about £30 million. De Valera made sure it stopped. The British, of course, then responded. 20% tax on imports as a result, and thus affected almost all the exports from the Irish Free State, which meant economically they were in serious trouble. De Valera was almost inviting a British attack. However, it should be noted that the land annuities were collected by British elites. That was stopped. It didn't keep the Free State itself from collecting these same annuities. So while it was banned with Britain, which was a great, you know, symbolic victory, the Free State was doing the exact same thing. All of this taken together was a giant blow to the Free State, showing what the nature of independence really is. You can't claim to be an independent country with a treaty that says these things. Not that I would have rejected it under the circumstances. I never quite made up my mind on that, especially given the British threats. But it had more to do with the dependence of the country on Great Britain. So the colonial status was eliminated, and that's it. All other forms of dependency remain. Slowly, of course, the obnoxious aspects of the treaty were eliminated over time, even before De Valera. But it reached a point, and the tariffs were passed very quickly when she was elected. The response from Britain was extreme, financially speaking. Because the annuities from the Free State were still going on, as the economy began to collapse, the farmers began to stop payments on their annuities, which meant that now the Free State was in a serious problem. Their former rentiers, the tenant farmers now owning land, a huge portion of the population, was refusing to assist the Free State. They weren't paying taxes, they weren't paying annuities, which meant the Free State was in a terrible position. And what it ended up doing was impounding livestock, which was a lifeblood of the Irish economy at the time, would impound them and then sell them below market prices. This is almost a Soviet tactic. You know, Soviet buying crops from peasants, collective farms way below market prices, meant that it wasn't even worth it to work anymore, so they had to use violence. In this case, the impounding of millions of heads of cattle, hence destroying the livelihood of the former tenant farmers, resulted now in violence. They tried to stop the trains, they tried to stop the sales, but the collapse of the rural economy meant that any market for industrial goods was now gone. Now the farmers had no money. They were in a terrible position, just like the Free State was, so whatever possible economic recovery was stymied at this point. The ideas that De Valera put out once he was elected were very good ones. Foreign firms, for example, had to have the majority of its stock owned by Irishmen. That makes sense, both politically and economically. But given the fragile state of the economy this period of time after De Valera's election, talking 32, 33, the height of the Depression, it meant that some of the biggest employers, like Guinness, for example, had to leave. They weren't going to sell off the majority of their stock to Irish investors. Therefore, they left and to this day are now a British company. We're always actually a British company. So the trade war, despite the ideological acceptance of everything, the fact that it was correct to do, the timing was the problem. 1932, the height of the Depression, going this way was simply financially unfeasible. Everyone was suffering, and then this also, to some extent, led to the support of millions of Irishmen in the Irish state for Germany in the mid-30s. So you had elements of the IRA going to the Soviet Union. You had a strong segment, a huge segment, of the Irish state going to Germany because they showed that the Depression could be conquered. Germany was the single most prosperous state under Hitler in the mid to late 30s. Anyone who attached itself to Britain, I'm sorry, to Germany at the time, was also going to do well. This is one of the reasons that you had, you know, for example, Yugoslavia, countries in Central Europe, supporting Germany for these very specific economic reasons. Germany was being rebuilt from World War I. But Germany was a national socialist state, not a capitalist one, proving the superiority of the system. And it was only World War II that brought the U.S. and Western Europe out of the Depression. The Depression was not conquered in any other way. So despite de Valera's actions being ideologically rational, they were financially irrational. Now, by this time, by the mid-30s, it wasn't a lot of the violence, the anti-treaty stuff was now fading into public memory, fading from public memory. So now the bigger issues were economic ones. Nationalism, of course, was always high, from the Catholic point of view. Anyway, Catholics in Ulster, as well as the rest of the country, the 32 southern counties. So there was a certain level of support for these things, but once the Free State began acting very much like the former British occupiers, it's the same thing, the Northern government after the Civil War in America, the colonial government after the Revolutionary War in America, it was far worse off than under British occupation in both cases. Censorship continued to remain. Catholicism could not be the official religion in the 32 counties, which, of course, was very popular. And it should be clear that so long as the Anglo-Irish Treaty lasted, any domestic law that contradicted it was automatically null and void, and the Governor General, of course, could veto it. That's why, in doing all of these things, this was, in fact, a dismantling of the treaty piecemeal. So what was popular, to the extent that removing dependence on Great Britain was a necessity, but extremely difficult to do. The transitional period was extremely difficult, and it was also hard to treat the United States, despite its large population, the Irish population, although they were mostly second-class citizens at the time, was difficult because the United States and Great Britain were very close. It's true that the U.S. Acknowledged and accepted the Free State, which was a huge blow to the anti-treaty forces. But that was about all it did in that respect. It supported Great Britain, and therefore the protected market to the United States were simply the end of the question. In fact, most places were erecting tariff walls, not before, but after the Depression destroyed the Western economy. All of this taken together showed ideologically a certain degree of support. De Valera made it clear that we are all going to suffer here, elites and everyone else, and we're going to suffer as a nation, no different than under British occupation. But then the Free State began to do these other kind of things. The impounding of cattle was one of the worst. The censorship never was lifted. And then you had riots and attacks and even guerrilla war against the Free State right in its own population. And unfortunately, Ulster was going to remain British. It was artificial. It was based on gerrymandering. It was based on economic power. But Ulster itself, industrially speaking, was far more powerful than the rest of Ireland put together. So, that's a thumbnail sketch of the Irish Civil War and its aftermath. The Depression made everything far more complicated because nationalist policies were very difficult to implement. But as far as the actual Civil War, 22-23, is concerned, the victory of the Free State really was a fait accompli. Despite the anti-treaty forces having a numeric advantage, those numbers didn't represent actual trained soldiers. In terms of discipline, the anti-treaty forces were far worse off than the Free State forces were. You were pretty much guaranteed wartime atrocities just out of things like exhaustion and seeing your friends getting killed, even on the best of times, but when you have no discipline. And discipline slowly getting worse as time went on, these things were guaranteed. The support that the U.S. threw to the Free State was yet another blow. Don't underestimate the Roman Catholic Church rejecting the anti-treaty forces as a massive, massive blow to the IRA. They had almost jettison the Roman Catholic allegiance if they were going to remain in the anti-treaty camp. They were refused all sacraments, including funerals, and this was made very clear. Now, I guarantee you there were individual clergymen in parishes that didn't go along with that. But at the very least, if for no other reason, stopping the violence amongst Catholics was at the top of the church's mind. Then the censorship, the media support, even without censorship, the electoral victories, the huge support that the treaty had, despite it not being in and of itself not popular, but if it meant forestalling civil war and a British invasion, it was supported by the overwhelming majority of the southern population. All of these taken together, not to mention the anti-treaty forces relying on terrorism, destroying civilian infrastructure, the house-burning campaign, the killing of the seven-year-old, despite the repercussions in the Free State, this sank the anti-treaty ship within a few months of the war breaking out. This is why the Free State won. And to this day, the two major parties in Ireland are descended from pro- and anti-treaty factions. It will always have repercussions. It's always good to now be a part of the Irish mind, and it will remain from here on in. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.